Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who gets by just knowing that there's booze in the blender. He is the captain.
If you're drunk enough, I'll pay you $10 to put your hand in there. Ooh! Ha! It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week we are very proud to be featuring DDH Noise Pollution by Southern Grist Brewing. Garage grade sound, the trumpets, 5 out of 5 bottle caps. This previously draft only double IPA has been brought back, but with some slight changes. First, a double dose of dry hops, and second, it's now in a can, and it's a beautiful pint sized can. And this week's beer is brought to us by our good friends. First up, a big shout out and cheers to my friend Mac down in Nashville. Thank you, Mac, for introducing me to Southern Grist Brewing Company.
And a big shout out to Amanda in Anderson, Indiana.
Next, a double cheers first to Betty from Kentucky and second to True Crime Sweden.
And a big we like your jib to Chelsea in Lanesville, Indiana.
Here's a cheers to Roman, who rocks TCG in his tractor while out in the fields in Pendleton, Oregon. And last but not least, we have Red and Joe in Iowa. Everyone we just mentioned went to truecrimegarage.com and helped us out with this week's beer fund. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, big cheers, mates. And make sure you rate us. Make sure you subscribe. Give us a good 5-star rating. And that is enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. Pick a country, and you likely can find a citizen who is killed ritualistically and repeatedly. Consider the phrase run amok, which derives from a Malay word translated loosely as to attack with homicidal mania, believing that amok was caused by an evil spirit. Indonesian culture tolerated these violent outbursts and dealt with the after effects with no ill will toward the assailant. The underlining premise: the capacity to kill indiscriminately dwells in all of us. Most people just suppress the urge or avoid the spirit. Still, the serial killer occupies a singular role in the cast of Americana. Here he, and the vast majority have been male, has been hyperbolized and fetishized and even romanticized. Serial killers are responsible for only a small fraction of the murders committed in the U.S., but they are some of the most notorious figures in our history and culture, says Sarah Weinman, who runs the newsletter The Crime Lady. Serial killing is twisted fantasy that has roots in the wide open American landscape, where it is all too easy to hunt and kill without detection and with impunity. It was in the 1970s that agents Robert Ressler and John Douglas of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit coined and defined the term serial killer, distinguishing one from a mass murderer who may kill many at once, or a spree killer who lacks a so-called cooling off period between murders. Indeed, the 70s marked the crimson-stained height of serial killing in the U.S. In that era, there were a number of factors working in the assailant's favor, from lax gun laws to the popularity of psychedelic drugs to the sprawling interstate highway system and cheap gas. And from the dearth of surveillance technology to the spotty coordination among police precincts, it may never have been easier to avoid getting caught. Taken from John Wertheim's SI.com long-form article titled The I-5 Killer, this is True Crime Garage. We start off on the evening of December 9th, 1980, in Vancouver, Washington. A 20-year-old female attendant is working the second shift at a gas station when, seemingly out of nowhere, a man suddenly appears. He was tall with dark hair, and on his face he had what was very obviously a fake beard. Before the attendant knew it, the man was standing right in front of her, and he had a gun. The man told her to open up the register and give him the money. She did as he requested. He then told her to turn around, and just like that, he was gone. The robbery was reported, and the attendant provided police with a description of a young, dark-haired man who was tall and had an athletic body type. And it was with this very quick but very terrifying event that a series of robberies and holdups started. Just days later, an ice cream parlor was hit. The next day, a drive-in restaurant. The robberies occurred in both Washington and Oregon. But then on December 21st, a different type of report came in. 200 miles away from the holdup at the drive-in restaurant in Seattle, Washington, a woman working at Church's Fried Chicken reported that before 9 p.m., she was in the women's restroom, washing her hands and face, when a man walked in. He said, "Excuse me," but he did not leave. Instead, he locked the door behind him. He put the gun to her head and said, "Do what I say and you won't get hurt." He then forced her to perform a sex act. And immediately after the assault, he left, but not before telling her to count to 100 before she dared to exit the restroom. She obeyed, and then out of fear, she stayed in the restroom, screaming for help. A co-worker called police. The victim gave a description of her attacker, a tall man with dark hair and a small silver gun. Who was the man with the silver gun who seemed to appear out of nowhere?
Well, Mr. Fake Weird Beard, was he wearing a beard during this attack?
So we have several robberies that take place, and we have at least one sexual assault. But in these cases, most of these cases he is wearing what is a fake beard, and it's not even like a good fake beard, because the witnesses are able to tell law enforcement.
Is there a such thing as a good fake beard?
I don't think there is, but
if there is, I've never seen one.
I know in one of the attacks that the beard was like hanging off his face. It wasn't really even attached to his face very well.
Mm-hmm.
The other key thing about these robberies is the witnesses will always tell law enforcement that the weird thing of the man seeming to just appear out of nowhere. And these are all storefronts and gas stations and drive-up restaurants. So what they mean by him appearing out of nowhere, it's not like they saw him get out of a car and walk into the establishment and then hold up the place. They said that they would turn around or look up from whatever they were doing, and he was standing right in front of them. By January of 1981, law enforcement had dubbed the robber the I-5 Bandit. This given his apparent preference for committing crimes along the Interstate 5 corridor. On January 8th, he held up the same Vancouver gas station he had robbed in December. 3 days later, on January 11th, he robbed a market in Eugene. The next day, on the 12th, he shot and wounded a female grocery clerk at a store in Sutherland, Oregon. In some of these robberies, the man had a Band-Aid or a piece of tape across the bridge of his nose. When he shot and robbed the grocery clerk in Oregon, he had two Band-Aids across the bridge of his nose. The woman survived, and the man made off with over $300 in cash. The bullet went into the woman's shoulder and out through her back. Police recovered the bullet. It was now evidence. And a possible witness reported seeing a VW Bug parked just outside of the grocery store around the time of the attack.
Yeah, and we all know that's not good.
This leads us to Salem, Oregon, January 18th, 1981, just before 10 p.m. An emergency call comes in. The caller is a woman, and she is asking for help. She tells the operator that we have been shot. A trace is put on the call, and the call is coming from the Trans-American Title Building. Squad cars and an ambulance are sent racing toward the building. The operator asks the woman for her name. The caller is having trouble speaking. Her voice is faint and her breathing is weak. Fighting through the pain, the caller says her name is Beth Wilmot and that they need to hurry because we have been shot in the head. And Beth is pretty sure her best friend, Sherry Hall, is already dead. The operator asks, "Who shot you?" Beth says it was a man, but she did not know him. Beth and Sherry were at the Trans-American building cleaning the office when a man walked in. She said the man was above average height with dark hair and a Band-Aid on his nose. The man was wearing a coat and jeans, and he was in his mid to late 20s. Beth said again and again that her friend Sherry is dying. Beth was afraid that the man was going to return. Now, a police officer arrived at the scene. He arrives there first, and he's alone. The emergency caller did not know if the shooter was still in the building. The officer, knowing the general layout of the building, he knew if he entered, he would become the perfect target should the shooter remain inside. But by the description of the attack and the injuries he heard on his police radio, he also knew if he didn't go in, the two women inside would surely die. So with a gun drawn, the officer kicked open the door and entered. The operator stayed on the line until the ambulance arrived. The shooter, thankfully, had left. Beth somehow survived this attack. Sherry did not. Despite her being shot in the head twice, luckily neither bullet penetrated Beth's skull. And she lived and she remembered a lot about the attack and about the attacker. In horrific detail, she was later able to describe both to detectives. The two women, Beth and Sherry, were best friends, and they operated an evening and weekend cleaning business. That Sunday night, they were cleaning the Trans-American building. They were almost done and getting ready to leave and go home for the night. Sherry unlocked the front door, went out to the parking lot, started up her red Bronco. She left it running and went back into the building just to finish up a few things. Just then, a man with a silver gun and a Band-Aid on his nose entered the building. He ordered the women to a room in the back. Once there, he threatens them. He makes them take off all of their clothes. He sexually assaulted both of the women. When he was done, he told both of them to lay face down on the floor next to each other. Then, standing over top of them, he shot Sherry in the head. Then he shot Beth in the head. Then Sherry again. Then Beth again. And then Sherry. Then he left.
Well, and Beth, after being shot the first time, she kind of plays dead, which is possibly what saved her life.
Yeah, Beth went on to say that she knew the man would just keep shooting them if they moved. So after that first shot, she made herself lie completely still and silent. But we do know he shot her again anyway, this probably just to make sure that she was dead. And Beth said that she was lucky because the man shot Sherry three times and she was only shot twice. Police were able to retrieve some evidence from the crime scene, but we have to keep in mind how difficult of a situation this would be to collect evidence. One, we have a guy that it seems like neither of the victim even knew. So what was he doing there in the first place? But then on top of that, we have first responders who their main objective, their first goal arriving on the scene is to preserve life, is to save the lives of these victims.
Right.
And when they arrived on the scene, both of these women, they were alive, but they're both clinging to life. They're very close to death. And so we have a situation of the police. They have to go in to save lives. They have first responders. We have medical technicians there. Everybody is working, and really they're trampling and contaminating the scene. Plus, we have the added factor of this is taking place in a building, and the police have to go in there and clear the building to make sure that the shooter is not still in this building. Luckily, they are able to retrieve some evidence from this crime scene, and they might have got lucky here because this is some pretty decent evidence. So first they find a single hair, which after some testing and comparing it to first responders, they believed, and the victims, they believed this hair to be from the suspect. They also were able to retrieve the suspect's blood type.
Was it a real hair or was it a fake hair?
This was a real hair, my friend. And they retrieved the suspect's blood type, which they later determined to be B negative. This is also a good thing for them because it eliminates quite a good deal of the male population. They also had a living witness. And most importantly, they found a bullet. Now, obviously, we know there were five shots, so there was more than one bullet, but
right.
One bullet was in great condition. This was a .32 caliber. And because of its condition, they were able to narrow it down to just a few different guns, meaning they had a very good idea of what kind of gun fired this bullet.
Right. Are they making the connection that this is their I-5 bandit yet?
They have not. But then we have this situation that is just 16 days later, and it's about 380 miles away and right off I-5. Just north of Redding, California. There was another attack, and this time it ended in a double homicide. Just before 9 p.m. on February 3rd, 1981, a young woman came home, and the house looked empty. She called out as she walked the house, but no one answered. When she reached the upstairs, she came into a bedroom and discovered the lifeless bodies of Donna Eckerd and Janelle Jarvis. Each had been shot several times in the head. One of the women was bound at the wrist and ankles, and her mouth and nose were covered with surgical tape. Detectives quickly deduced that both were alive and well just less than 3 hours earlier. This because of a phone call that took place with Donna.
Yeah, because the person that was on that phone call is also the person that found the bodies.
Yeah, Donna told the caller that she and Janelle were going to go down to Jake's Market to pick up some items for breakfast the next day. Now, inside of one of the women's pants pocket, detectives found a handwritten check made out to Jake's Market. Interviews conducted at Jake's Market determined that the two never made it to Jake's. Someone had intercepted them.
Right.
Law enforcement also determined that the victim had only been dead maybe an hour before they were discovered. They were both killed with a .32 caliber gun. Now, back in Salem, we have Beth Wilmot, the one who almost died, was shot in the head twice. She is recovering from her two gunshot wounds to the head. And to everyone's surprise, she is healing much faster than anticipated. She's able to give detectives a description of the man that killed her friend and that tried unsuccessfully to kill her. Now, with some good old-fashioned detective work, the Salem police were now working under the theory and suspicion that the killer was not a local. This leads them to sending out a teletype to police offices in other jurisdictions and other states. Now, they are asking if any community had experienced a similar homicide. Immediately, they got a response from the Redding, California area. After comparing notes, they firmly believed that the two cases were linked. They were, in fact, the same type of crimes, same caliber gun, and both right along the I-5 corridor. Then, Salem released the following description to other jurisdictions and to other states. Salem police were looking for a male white, 25 to 28 years old, 5'11" to 6'1" tall, medium build, described as good build, with dark hair, possibly curly collar length, and dark eyes, pale or light complexion, described as being good looking, and has sad eyes, with more white showing below the iris. The suspect wears a black or orange knit cap, a green hooded coat, brown cord or sheepskin lined jacket, green windbreaker. The coat's always buttoned. Blue jeans in all incidences. White tennis shoes with red stripe. Blue driving type gloves with open back. They go on to describe the gun that is believed to have been used in these crimes. A possible H&R, break top 6-shot revolver. Vehicle, a 66 or later light-colored VW Bug, possibly modified in some manner. Now, keep in mind, regarding this vehicle, that's more of a suspicion rather than they're saying that we've seen this in all of these incidences.
Right.
And because we have multiple attacks and robberies and such that have taken place, we have a different description of what this suspect could be wearing. After the description goes out, more police agencies contacted Salem. The description matched that of the robberies and holdups that we previously discussed, and in the following. February 3rd in Redding, a female store clerk was kidnapped, raped, and a holdup. An identical crime was reported in Wairika on February 4th, with the same man robbing an Ashland, Oregon motel that same night. 5 days later in Corvallis, a man matching the description held up a fabric store, molesting the clerk and a customer before he left. On February 12th, there were robberies committed in Vancouver, Olympia, and Bellevue, Washington. The Olympia and Bellevue incidences included sexual assaults. Some jurisdictions were looking for the I-5 bandit. Some jurisdictions were looking for the I-5 killer. And as police were learning, the two were one and the same.
And at this point, did they decide to change his name from the I-5 killer to Broken Dick Nose Fake Beard?
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You can live out your MasterChef dream when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
All right, we're back.
Cheers. So now we have police from several jurisdictions that are now in communication with each other. They are sharing the details of the robberies, the assaults, and the murders, and what evidence and witness statements they may have. These are dedicated detectives determined to solving these murders and ending this crime spree. And to ensure that they can track this guy down, they want to know everything about him. So they start to put together a psychological profile and list out what is known about the offender's modus operandi. Here is what they come up with. They are looking for a male Caucasian who has a macho image of himself, recently divorced or separated from a lover, recently released from penal or mental institution. This man would be described as a nice guy and would not be considered a suspect by a friend or neighbors. The motivation in all of these incidents is primarily sexual. He is a loner. Some things to consider. The offender has not hit Portland or Multnomah County. Does not like location with men present. Has not hit outside of time span. They had narrowed down most of these attacks to taking place in the early evening hours. So when they reference time span, that's what they are stating. This is with the exception of one incident that took place in February in Eugene, Oregon. The offender has only hit one convenience store. Takes Band-Aid off when fleeing. Tape is an unknown brand. Now, this is tape that was used to bind the victims. And also, we have to consider that on some of these attacks, it's not a Band-Aid across the bridge of his nose. It is some type of tape. The individual parks 1 to 4 blocks away from the scene, is never seen by the clerk prior to the incident. They go on to say that they suspect that the individual may be hiding glasses marks on nose with the Band-Aid or the tape. They go on to discuss the offender's method of operation, stating that the offender picks a location where young girls are working or likely to work. He prefers to hit in the evening hours between 5:40 p.m. and 11 p.m. Only attacks during slack times of operation. This is when the businesses would not be busy. There wouldn't be a lot of traffic in and out of these businesses. He is armed with a .32 caliber nickel-plated revolver. He ties or tapes victims. Has victim disrobe, but he stays dressed. In 13 of these 23 incidences, there were sexual assaults. The older female victims are only fondled. The offender is soft-spoken and not verbally abusive. He takes the victims to the back room. No drug, alcohol, or tobacco odors are detected by victims. He is never seen casing the businesses. He has his own vehicle. Parks up to 4 blocks away, wears Band-Aid on nose, and he has used a wig and or fake beard as a disguise. He also takes the telephone receiver away from the scene. This occurred in almost all of the attacks in which there was somebody shot or some type of sexual assault. This seemingly so they can't call police immediately after he leaves. The hood of his jacket always stays on, and he wears gloves, but may take them off to fondle the victims. He has victims count to 100 as he is leaving the scene.
Well, the first question for me becomes the true motive, you know, because they're not convinced that all these, what, there's 23 attacks and robberies, 13 of them sexual. It seems like to me that there's a double motive. And it's not just sexual. It's that this guy needs money.
Yeah, I agree with that. He needs money, but also he also needs this sexual satisfaction.
Yeah.
Because that's if the primary motive is simply money, he's putting himself at a much greater risk to assault these women.
Agreed. But in every scenario there is money taken, correct?
I don't think that there was in the first sexual assault that we described where he walked into the restroom where the woman was already in there.
But it's like escalating, right? Like it seems like there was a couple robberies. And then once he figured, it's almost like this guy figured out I can control this situation enough that not only do I get money, but now I can, then the motive then becomes sexual.
I actually think what's going on here is kind of a two-pronged motive. One, I think you're absolutely right. This guy needs the money. But I think money is mainly secondary to his motivation for these crimes. I think sexual is the primary motivating factor here. I think that in situations where we have a robbery that occurs and there is not a sexual assault, I think there's something else going on there. One, it could be practice to see how much he believes he can control a situation.
Right.
And to also just kind of see what's going to go down and then later determine, okay, it's safe for me to be here for a longer period of time. I'm more comfortable controlling these victims and more comfortable controlling the scene of the robbery. And so I think that the primary motivating factor here is the sexual aspect. But I also think that in some of these situations, he could either get spooked and just want to get the money and get out of there.
Yeah.
Or he sees a situation where he thinks they might fight back or he might not be able to control the situation. What I'm getting at is there's some variable there that comes into play in the situations where sexual assault does not occur that we probably will never understand.
Well, he also might be looking for a certain type.
Correct.
Because he's just going into these random places almost.
Well, and that's what I think that the police are trying to point out here, where they say his motivation, you know, one of his methods of operation is he picks locations where young women are working or likely to work.
Right.
Okay.
And then when he's fondling older women, he's just fondling them.
Mm-hmm.
So
it does appear he has some type of
right
victimology, some type that he may be looking for in these sexual assaults. The interesting thing here, though, too, is, like you pointed out, in this situation, they're never going to be 100% certain that all 23 of these incidences are, in fact, connected and committed by the same offender.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is when they're pulling together their information that they know, things that they know occurred during the committing of these crimes and things that the offender said and did, his actions, they're comparing notes and these lists that they're providing us. Now, mind you, this is not something that they wanted to send out there, but they're not so much putting it forward to the public. They're just sharing it with other jurisdictions and other states.
Mm-hmm.
This is a time when jurisdictions didn't always work together very well or cooperate together. And I'm sure
technology wasn't there as well.
And I'm sure on some level it took some convincing from one police department to another to point out that we may be dealing with the same guy and we all need this to stop, because not only is this guy hitting all these places and this is rapid fire attack here. We're talking about 23 incidences in a short period of time.
Well, they mentioned somebody that might have just got out of a relationship. Somebody that just got maybe divorced.
Yeah, and, or recently released from a penitentiary or a mental institution.
Yeah, which would then go with the whole no job thing. I'd also put on that description possibly a guy that recently just lost a job or job opportunity because, again, that money, it's always there. The sexual assaults are not always there, but it's almost in every case there is some money being taken. Now, $300 is not, and I think one of the cases it was $300, not a huge amount of money. But I wonder if that's because this guy knows, I'm just going to keep doing this again. So what does it matter if I just only, if I only get 300? He's not doing anything that is setting himself up for a big takeover.
Well, and obviously we didn't go through all 23 of those situations because it's just too much to list out and just too much to go through. But on some occasions, he's hitting more than one place where there's a robbery and or sexual assault. He's hitting more than one place in the same day.
Right.
So, like you said, he knows he's going to rob again. He knows that regardless if it's $10 or $100 in the till, there will be another robbery soon.
Well, right, and I like the fact that they say, look, he only hit one convenience store. And so there was something about that convenience store, whether it was too difficult to take over, maybe it was too difficult to control, is the more customers, the possibility of more customers, then he can control the situation, or is it just simply, there was not enough money there? Is that one of the reasons why he only hit one convenience store?
Well, we should also keep in mind, we're not talking about something that took place 5 or 10 years ago. These crimes that we've described so far here are 1980, 1981. So back then, we have an average salary in the United States of like $13,000 to $14,000. So
right.
$300 is a good hit for him. We're talking about, this is a guy that is probably pulling down enough, be it whether there's a little bit of money or something more substantial like $300, that he might be able to survive off of just these hits, just off of these robberies. So where you say that somebody, we should also so factor in and consider somebody who recently lost a job, I think you're spot on there, because what they're pointing out here is recently divorced or separated from a girlfriend or lover. You're adding in loss of job or loss of opportunity. That's fantastic, because they want to know something triggered this.
Yeah.
We have the similar description and all of these incidences. So something triggered this, and once that trigger was set, this guy hit the ground running, and he committed a lot of crimes and at a fast pace.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to know what was preventing him from doing this in the first place. Maybe he was married and didn't need the money.
Yeah, it's weird though too, because he's described as attractive. So you would think, I lean to that idea where they're saying, oh, well, possibly he was in a relationship or married, some kind of sexual needs were being met, and for some reason now, here's this attractive man, he's newly single, and instead of going and trying to meet another mate, this is how he is going about his life now.
Yeah, and some of our listeners do not like when they hear the description that's put forward by law enforcement that the offender is described as good looking. And I get that, but this is a quick reminder that monsters don't always look like monsters.
Right.
And we have this situation here where in some of these incidences, you know, they're asking questions to these victims saying, be it for a robbery or sexual assault or what have you, they're asking them very simple things to try to lead them to who the offender is. You know, what did anything seem off? Was there anything weird going on, or did you notice anything out of the ordinary before the attack occurred? Well, no, I didn't notice anything. Nothing seemed off that day. So that's where they're going. they're saying, well, it doesn't appear that he is casing the business, that he's watching the business and then hitting.
Right. That'd take too much time. There seems to be a frequency here.
And then the added factor of, they say, well, he's parking his vehicle 1 to 4 blocks away and fleeing the scene. That's, they can simply come up with that by going, okay, after the attack, did you hear or see a vehicle leave the property, leave right. the premise? No, did not. And none of them. So they know that this guy is fleeing on foot. Furthermore, when it comes to the good looking thing, I know of one of these incidences where when the victim was asked, was there anything weird or out of the ordinary before the attack? She said that the strangest thing occurred before the attack is that this dirty looking younger guy came in, and she said the man had a threatening appearance. And the guy said to her something to the effect of, you know, this would be an incredibly easy place to rob.
Mm-hmm.
And this put her on edge. Well, this threatening looking individual, according to her statement, made a small purchase and then left. And she said the oddest thing about this whole holdup to her was that shortly after this weird looking dude left,
mm-hmm.
this good looking tall man, clean cut, comes in, and my guard was down because of his appearance. And then he's the one that robs me. So right. That's where we have that statement of possibly good looking.
Right. Have we had any other statements like that before that they saw a dirty guy? I'm only throwing that out there because we have a guy that's possibly wearing wigs and wearing a fake beard. And then with the whole tape on the nose, it's really like he's trying to do the tape on the nose thing is weird, or the Band-Aid on the nose. Cause to me, one, it's like, a broken nose,
mm-hmm.
or possibly, you know, to open up the nose a little bit. And I would only say that because possibly he's parking, you know, very far away. Some people, you know, I'm just throwing out straws there. You know, is he wearing this because he's sprinting to and from the places? But we have these disguises. Is this guy putting on a disguise and going in there and casing the joint? They say he's not casing the joint, but what if he's casing the joint as another character?
Well, I have to believe that they were just wrong about that in some form, because you don't get lucky 23 times. You don't go into a business 23 times and commit some kind of crime and then get away scot-free.
Right.
That's just playing the numbers game there. It doesn't add up. So I have to believe that in some way.
Yeah, but there's a lot that you can learn from parking 2 blocks away from a place and then approaching it. You know what I mean? So I think their statement is almost bogus by default.
Well, I don't think he was sitting there for hours or on multiple days watching
these businesses.
What we see is somebody who is offending in multiple jurisdictions, and we're talking, a lot of these are hundreds of miles away from each other, but they're all off of this I-5 interstate. So I think this is somebody with a good knowledge of that interstate and the businesses along the way. I think this is somebody that probably travels the I-5 a good deal. And in his travels, maybe he's learning, he's doing a bit of intel along the way. And yeah, he can make a side note and say, that gas station that I stopped at tonight that I got gas from, I didn't stop there to case the joint. I stopped there because my tank was low and I needed gas.
Right.
Oh, it was 8:30 p.m. There was a young woman working alone in the gas station. It's Thursday and there was no other customers here. And you could just make a quick mental note of that and say, you know what? If I'm back in Eugene, Oregon on this date, you know, on this day next week at 8 p.m., this might be a spot to hit. And then with the disguise stuff, I love the suspicion or the question of, could the tape or Band-Aid be used for hiding glasses marks on the nose? You know, that this would be somebody that in his everyday life, he wears glasses. Mm-hmm. But that could be an identifier. So when committing these crimes, he is not wearing these glasses. And to cover that up, he's put this Band-Aid or tape across the bridge of his nose. And I think that's an easy conclusion to come up with. I think it's creative. But where you make that leap is you know that he's used a fake beard in more than one occasion. So he is making some attempt at disguising himself.
Right.
And he may have taken it a step further and come up with this idea to use the Band-Aid or the tape across the bridge of his nose.
Well, and even with the fake beard or the tape or the Band-Aid, like it causes a distraction from natural features. So,
yeah.
I mean, even if it's not really so much to cover up, you know, a broken nose or the glasses marks on the bridge of the nose, it just creates a distraction in general. And then I thought about the frequency of how much this is happening. Like you said, there could be a robbery one day and then later that day, sexual assault. And so to me, that leans towards possible like alcoholism or some addiction, but they're not smelling any alcohol, and there's no, like, it seems like this guy is coming in and they're going, he was not suspicious. So there's almost no signs of drug activity.
Well, and I think you're right there. This to me would point to a very organized offender. We have somebody that has determined that it's best for him to park not near the business and to enter and leave on foot. He is arriving and he's attempting to disguise himself. He's wearing gloves in all of these incidences, so he's not leaving fingerprints behind. He's also very organized in the way that he controls the situation and really follows almost the same script each time. You know, taking the victim to the back room where they're concealed. And so I think we are dealing with somebody that might not be incredibly intelligent, but he's at least good at doing this thing. Right. And he is organized in the sense that that's why I go, you know, to back up what the victims were saying, no drug, alcohol, or tobacco odors. He does not appear to be out of control in any of these situations. He doesn't appear to be out of his mind or drunk or anything like that. He's not making a lot of mistakes.
Well, they also point out that he didn't hit a couple areas. Like all of his attacks were outside those areas. And so that makes you wonder, do they believe that he's from that area that he's not attacking at? Because he's would be more likely to be known in those areas.
Yeah, that was Portland or Multnomah County, as well as he only hit Eugene, Oregon seems to be a place that he has hit, but only once maybe during all of this. So you're right. When we have all of these attacks, now he does have hundreds of miles to choose from for these attacks.
Right, right.
But for whatever reason, he seems to be staying out of those areas. But while we were saying that they can never be 100% convinced that all of these incidences are, in fact, all linked to one another. The very interesting thing here is when they're comparing notes, they're seeing the same stuff in these all 23 of these things. We got the offender's actions, the way that he speaks to the victims. We also have a very similar description in all of these incidences, as well as the same description of the weapon used during which. So it's good that they're sharing information. It's bad that they now know that they're dealing with a guy that is roaming basically the countryside and roaming the West Coast up and down the I-5. And he doesn't seem to be stopping or even slowing down when committing these crimes. On February 15th, now keep in mind, Captain, this is just 3 days after multiple attacks took place on the 12th. 18-year-old Julianne writes, she is at a party. She is leaving that party. This is around 2 a.m. She tells all of her friends that she is heading home. Julianne writes lives with her mother at Southwest Cherry Hill Drive. This is in Beaverton, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her mother is out of town that night, and when her mother returns the next day, she finds the body of Julie Wrights, finding her lying nude on the stairs, her hair bloodstained. She had been shot point blank in the head.
Yeah.
The time of death was later determined to be between 3 and 4 a.m. Police recovered a .38 caliber bullet from the victim. There was an eyewitness statement that said that the only thing that he noticed out of the ordinary was that he had seen a VW bug driving up and down Julie's street that night. Police went on to interview about 150 people who were closest to Julie, who were in her social circles. They believed that none of the people they interviewed made for a good suspect. Now, this case is not connected to the I-5 killer. For one simple fact, the police were working under the suspicion that Julie knew her killer. They based this off of what they found at the crime scene. Julie Wrights had shared a glass of wine with her attacker, and she had also was in the process of preparing coffee for two.
Okay.
And somewhere in this process, she is gunned down by her assailant. So what we have here is you come up with, well, why did they come up with this? Well, this is easy to put together. They know that Julie lives with her mother. When's the last time you saw Julie? What time were you last at your home? Oh, Julie was already gone for the day. I left. When I returned, I find my daughter dead. We know that Julie came home that night, and then they find wine glasses and somebody, you know, evidence to suggest that somebody was in the process of making or serving coffee. So we're under the assumption that Julie knew the killer well enough to let the individual into the home and spend some time talking with him.
But we have a sexual assault and we have shots to the head.
Mm-hmm. So this is why they are very interested in interviewing all the people that are closest to her. This is your obvious go-to. They believe that out of those 150 people, approximate 150 people, that none of the people that they interviewed made for a good suspect. This points them to a different thought, that their suspect is known to the victim, Julie writes, but would be on the fringes of her life and social circles.
Yeah.
They're going to have to go back and re-interview all of these people, or a good majority of them. This is because now they're not looking at any of those individuals as actual suspects. They are wanting to get more information from them on who are the people that kind of knew Julie. Is there anyone that stands out? Is there a guy that she might have known? They come up with two or three different people out of this group of 150 that mention a name of an individual that Julie had some type of relationship with. It seems like they worked together at one point. This man took her on a date, maybe two, but Julie didn't really want a relationship with this individual. The name that's presented to them is Randall Woodfield. He is somebody that worked at the Faucet with Julie Wrights. This was a bar, and I believe that Woodfield was a bouncer or possibly a bartender. He worked from time to time as a bouncer and or bartender at some of these different bars. This Faucet bar is located in Portland, so not terribly far away. Apparently, he didn't last very long working at this bar because, yeah, he must have been a bouncer because it says in my notes here that he was let go because he didn't seem comfortable removing people from the bar.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to track down this Randy Woodfield and give him a strong looking at.
Give him the business.
Well, the other added factor here too is one of the individuals that supply police with his name says, you know, what do you know about this guy? Well, I know that he did some time or got in trouble for some robberies years ago. Okay, so now we have a guy that actually fits what they're looking for, that's on the fringes of her life and social circles. Yeah. And then on top of that, it's a guy with a record.
Right, but riddle me this. Is he wearing a fake beard?
Well, police do, once they have his name, they want to go talk to him because it's very simple. This is our next guy in line here. This is somebody that is pointed out to us by two or three of the people that knew Julianne Wrights. So let's go talk to him because he could either be a suspect, or if he has an alibi that is good, then we can clear him and move on with our investigation. So they have to travel out to Eugene, Oregon, and they meet with Randy Woodfield. He answers the door when they knock, and they're talking to him. And early on in their conversation, they say, "Hey, do you know somebody named Julianne Wrights?" And he says, "No, I can't place the name. I don't know anybody by that name." To which police follow up with the question of, "Well, would you mind coming to our police department and discussing some things with us there?"
Right.
Because this is what's going to set off some alarm bells for the investigators. We have a guy that wants to lie about knowing Julianne Wrights, who was found murdered. Yet we have at least two or three people that say not only did they know each other, but there was some type of involvement.
Which is interesting, because this happens a lot in cases. It's when the person lies about knowing the victim, the red flags go up. Mm-hmm. But me and you, we're good with faces, bad with names. And so it's like I could totally see you being interviewed by the police and then asking you, "Do you know so and so?" And you going, "Well, I don't think so." You know.
I get that, but one of the witnesses are saying that they went on a date together. The other is saying that Randy was aggressively pursuing a relationship with Julianne Wrights.
So it wasn't just they worked together.
It's not that they just happened to cross paths and work together for a brief time period together. And right. On top of that, when he worked at the faucet was less than 6 months before they're questioning him about Julianne Wrights.
Right, but again,
so it's not a good deal of time, and it's also others' perception that they were at least friends or went on a date together.
Right, right. I would say the friends are being pursued by this guy. That's definitely more of a reason why he would know her than that they worked at a bar together, which there's a ton of turnover at bars too. So,
well, and think about this from Randy's perspective, because he doesn't know everything that the investigators that are talking to him, he does not know what they know.
Right.
And he is technically, when he's asked that question, he's in a no-win situation. This is lose-lose, baby, because if he says, "Yes, I do know her," well, they've already stated that they are looking for somebody that knew her as right. A very good suspect. But when he says, "No, I did not know her," this makes it a double whammy, because now they want to know why, one, we're looking for somebody that knows her, but why does this man want to lie and say that he does not know her?
Thank you so much for joining us back in the garage. So much more to get to next episode. Won't you please join us?
Yeah, we'll be back for part two tomorrow. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.